Good morning, John Marion for Sisto Andrew. Can I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal? My left arm shakes a lot of times from an old motorcycle accident. It's not because I'm nervous. Well, I am nervous too, but that's not my arm shaking. My argument is real short and simple. A shipping company cannot condition an injury settlement on having the seaman give up his occupation. That's it in a nutshell. Other than that, I really have nothing to add to the briefing. Could I take questions from the court?
Let me ask a question that is not clear from the briefing. As you know, setting aside arbitration awards requires you to meet the statutory criteria for setting aside an award. On which basis do you rely for that?
Your Honor, I confess I don't have the statute memorized, but it's an issue of law that the arbitrator did not have the legal capacity to order a seaman to give up his occupation for 20.
Okay, so you're saying essentially that the arbitrator exceeded his authority?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, thank you.
What case, if any, are you relying on as the clear statement of public policy that he didn't have, that no one has the authority to make somebody give up their job?
In this context, none. In the context of confidentiality, non-compete agreements, that's what I'm relying on. The employer cannot go beyond what is necessary to protect their interests. And I don't think the only interest that OSG has is that Sisto Andrew not ship out again on their ships. That's legitimate. But preventing him from exercising an occupation at all, that is too broad. It goes beyond the bounds.
So getting back to, I mean, what happened is that there was a lawsuit, right, that was settled. And that was one of the terms of the settlement.
Correct.
So you're saying that what should have happened was that they shouldn't have inserted that agreement. That shouldn't have never come up, and that they should have just gone to trial on the case.
I'm saying they should have restricted that no-sale agreement to OSG ships.
But, I mean,
that would have been
your client accepted it, though. I mean, potentially, if he had not made that agreement, then he would have had to go to trial.
I wasn't there, but probably yes.
Yeah. So, but he agreed to give up his livelihood.
He did agree to it, and he violated that agreement. I'm not making any excuses for him.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll reserve my time.
That's right.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Noah Jaffe here on behalf of OSG Ship Management. As Mr. Miriam indicated, the facts of this matter are not in dispute. The arbitration award is clear, it's well articulated, and in this case it sets the outer limits for the scope of the Court's review. And I think, as the Court has already homed in on, the standard of review in this case is particularly instructive, where we have an arbitration award in place. Mr. Andrew's arguments, to the extent that they seek to relitigate issues that the arbitrator considered and rejected, are outside the scope of this Court's review, which is constrained to the face of the award itself. He's obliged to show that the arbitrator exceeded his authority by pointing to some facial legal error on the face of the award itself, and he has not pointed to any portion of that award that constitutes that facial legal error. Now, there is also, as the Court recognized, a public policy exception to that sort of presumption that an arbitration award is valid. That's an arbitration award could be vacated if it violated some explicit, some well-defined, some dominant public policy. Again, Mr. Andrew hasn't pointed to any such public policy that's violated here.
He claims he's pointed to it by reference to the cases involving covenants not to compete and so forth.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The case law that he relies on and concedes arises solely in the context of those types of non-compete agreements, those employment agreements before employment is entered into.
Well, context aside, but I mean, the point is aren't those cases decided on the principle that people have a right to make a living?
Yes, Your Honor.
They have a right to make the living that they're used to making. I mean, in other words, I'm not saying this very well, but to practice an occupation or a profession that they're familiar with.
Well, the arbitrator considered that argument and found it to not be persuasive, but nonetheless, considering its merits, the context of a settlement agreement is significantly distinguishable from the context of those types of employment agreements. And in this instance in particular, that provision was inserted and based on Mr. Andrews' own assertion that he was permanently disabled, that he would never be able to ship out again. And that was an assertion.
Do you think that an employer should be able to say, okay, you say that you're mentally impaired, so we'll settle with you, but you have to agree to never exercise your right to vote and never have children or never do anything that might require you to be competent in your mind?
Well, the mental impairment component to your question, I think, is significant, and Mr. Miriam has suggested that seamen may be entitled to some sort of heightened deference or protection from the court on a historical basis. I think in both instances here, those considerations are inapplicable in his case.
I'm not really asking about that. I'm wondering how far your argument goes. I mean, because I'm imagining these other things that would seem kind of offensive. If you know, a person is claiming mental impairment, the defendant doubts it, but is willing to settle, but thinks, well, we'll fix him, we'll make sure he never works again, and then that really puts him to, he has to really, really be sure that he's mentally impaired. What if one of those other types of terms were asserted? Do you think those should hold up, even if an arbitrator finds that they're okay, you have to agree you'll never have children, you have to agree you'll never exercise your right to vote, we want to be sure that you stay mentally impaired?
I would certainly concede there's some limit to the scope of that type of agreement. I would contend that limit is nowhere near implicated in this instance. The point I was coming to in a roundabout way is that Mr. Andrew, throughout the negotiations that he engaged in freely, had the advice of a capable, experienced maritime attorney. He had the advice of treating physicians, consulting physicians, vocational experts, and all of them insisted that he was permanently disabled, that he would never be able to sail again. And this provision and the money that he received in recognition thereof was acknowledging, I should say, OSG was skeptical of that assertion and unwilling to pay the amount that it ended up paying, which was over $500,000, $525,000.
Well, why not just go to trial and prove that he's not impaired then?
I would contend that trial would have been his proper remedy if he didn't wish to be bound by the terms of this agreement. However, with the advice of counsel, he was free to do so. And once he had, then he had relinquished the right to go to trial. If he did not wish to be bound by the terms of a settlement agreement that he found improper but clearly understood and had been advised on, he was free to do so and to proceed to trial. And in fact, that would have been a better remedy if he in fact had no intention of abiding by the terms of the agreement that he had entered into, and that was the basis for my client being willing to offer a great deal more in settlement than it otherwise would have. So the public policy concerns that he's raising,
then it otherwise would have, but what did your client really get out of it?
My client's
get out of his promise.
Certainly,
I mean,
certainly.
Mr. Merriam says, well, this is different from Sealand because there the person just, you know, he couldn't work for Sealand again, which is a little easier to swallow.
In essence,
but in this case, he can't work as a Coast Guard certified person.
That's a reflection of...
What was the benefit to your client from that, from having him not on the water at all?
The benefit, if any, was assuaging my client's doubts that he was being truthful about the permanence of his disability. The fact that he was willing to say, and that his physicians and his attorney and his vocational experts were willing to say, yes, he's permanently disabled, he'll never sail again, was something that my client was skeptical of. And when that, the fact that and when he was willing to stand by that assertion with that provision was what ultimately induced my clients to raise its settlement offer to over $500,000. I should add also the settlement agreement and the funds paid thereunder were in recognition of the permanence of his disability. In essence, he's already been compensated for the fact that he will never be able to sail again, that he'll need to retrain, that he'll need to seek employment in some other field which is less demanding, perhaps.
I realize that he blew the money and that Mr. Merriam admits that, but what if he had actually taken the money and spent it on an extremely top-flight rehabilitation program and it was successful enough so that it turned out he wasn't impaired anymore? And then he went tried to go back to work. Would your position be the same?
Yes. I think the provision nonetheless was based at the time on providing that reassurance to my client, and if he indeed believed or his physicians believed that he would be able to sail again, then the settlement amount would have been lessened and that would have been reflected in the parties' negotiations at settlement. In essence, the public policy concerns in this instance, actually, array against Mr. Andrew. There are concerns focused on the finality of arbitration awards, the finality of settlements, and the party's freedom to contract. And it's that last one, the party's freedom to contract, which is of particular significance here when he's represented by counsel, when he's fully availed of his faculties and understanding what he's agreeing to be bound by. As the arbitrator recognized, it's unjust and it's unjust enrichment for him to both insist during settlement negotiations that he's permanently disabled and needs to be compensated in accordance with that fact, and then also seek to promptly thereafter, just months after cashing the check, set about breaching the very agreement that he'd signed. I think that those few months passing in between are very instructive in this particular instance where he signed the agreement, he cashed the check, and mere months afterwards communicated with the Coast Guard that he was fully recovered and able to sail again. That would reflect a willful breach, in my opinion, a breach that perhaps he intended at the time of signing the agreement at the outset. And the arbitrator recognized that the equities were not in his favor and that it was unjust enrichment for him to both breach the terms of the agreement and continue to enjoy the benefit that he received thereunder.
Is there a limit somewhere to the rule you espouse? Judge Becker asked earlier. Where is the limit?
I believe there would be a limit, but the limit would be invoked in an instance where the party wasn't fully advised by counsel or in their full faculties, and that's
so
not an issue.
If this was his spouse with a loss of consortium claim, he would be able to enforce a settlement agreement that she not have conjugal relations with her husband for the rest of her life.
I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know that this case requires an answer to that question. I recognize there would be a limit.
Next case might.
Certainly.
So is there a limit? Where is the limit?
I think the cases that Mr. Merriam and Mr. Andrew cite to, I guess I should say, given the context of the arbitration award in place, the burden in this case is on Mr. Andrew, not on OSG, to show some facial error on that award. And OSG is not in possession of a burden to establish where that limit would be, but just that limit has not been reached in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have little to add other than I think the court zeroed in on the issue of public policy. Public policy is workers be allowed to work. And then the shipping company, all employers have to be protected. But OSG can show no harm for him going from Mr. Andrew going shipping out with another company. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Merriam. Your succinctness is appreciated.